then of further instances of attack by tank and your involvement in that?
It wasn't until the fort, there were other actions on other fronts in our areas, but we weren't involved in it apart from taking the back wash of artillery actions and things of that nature. But it wasn't until I think it was the night of the 13th, 14th, or the night of the 14th, I'm not too sure about that, but it was a normal sort of a day. I mean, people were getting around. There was no down the ground all the time. I mean, there was a fair bit of movement around. The main thing was that, you know, there's always somebody able to control and fire the gun if something did happen whilst you're away. But on this particular, just about sunset, we heard these tanks coming, started up from over behind a hillock, which was out in front of us, I suppose, or 1,000 or more metres. And you could hear the, and you knew it wasn't one, there was a number of them by the sound, and then eventually they appeared from behind the hold down position area that they were in, and they started heading to the towards the sea, but east of us a little, and they had to come across the railway line. This, for matter of interest, this railway line was from Cairo or Alexandria up to Derna or one of those areas to the east of us. And also alongside the railway line was the water pipe line, which the water main carried on probably further up towards Derna area. I'm not too sure how far it went, but anyway, they came across this headed across the railway line. And by this time, the artillery were onto them, and when they were east of our positions, that's the Cairo side of our positions, and there weren't any troops or fortifications in that particular area, and. And as they got over the railway line, the artillery barrage intensified, and they did pass a little bit below our gun area. And by the way, there were 8 tanks at the time. And because of the artillery intensification on them, they switched in the west, or did a switch towards our direction, which there were 4 guns, three guns, I think, on the boundary alongside the 40. A company of the 48th Battalion, the 2nd 48th Battalion, and they'd swung west towards us, and weren't too happy about that. And we had to sort of make a decision here what we were going to do, because it's no use with a 2-pounder which had an effective range of about 400 yards against a 30 or 40 ton tank, highly armoured in the front, carrying either a 50 millimetre gun or a 75, which had, you know, 1,000 odd yards range. So if they had proceeded straight for us, well, we'd have probably had to have a go at them, but I wouldn't be here to tell the story. But they did move towards the ocean, and that's towards the north a bit. So it was no use taking on the first one, because the eight behind him had picked it up in a stride. So common sense prevailed, and we said, right, we start from the back. And that's what we did. And there are various stories of who got what and all those sorts of things with, you know, with other guns in action. But we just started from the back and went down the line, and instead of firing into the front of the tank, we were firing into the sides of the tank, which was thinner and less strength than the frontal part of the tanks. So we were just boring holes into those, and you can imagine what would happen with a 2-pound solid steel shell floating around inside the tank. So we went down the line to four or five, but the other a gun of the other troop, they had virtually had to take them on frontally, and they were knocked out, and the gun layer was killed. And the gun commander, his gun, he was accredited with 3 or 4, and our gun crew were credited with 4. But one of the tank that we first attacked, we weren't sure what happened to that, whether we knocked it out or whether it broke down, because that night, when in the darkness, the tank recoveries came in and it was dragged out, and the infantry did go out, and from what I've been told afterwards, that they had the spandos and everything around this tank while they were getting it out. But of course, other things are sort of coming back in my memory now, how they, I think it was that particular night, that some of the English-speaking Germans were around about us, and they were calling out, "Are you there, Jack?" sort of business. And of course, there's no response from us. But that went on for quite a while, so there was obviously they were out after us somehow. But what we did do when it all quietened down, and there was, we removed the firing pin, and because we didn't have any infantry close by to, when I say close by, we would have been 100 yards away from on our own from the actual infantry. So we decided that the best thing we could do is to take the firing pin and go back to the infantry and stay there for a while, and then come back again, which we did do. But in the meantime, the infantry were doing patrols out in front of us.
Did you know of the success of your the operations in your position in relation to the wider picture of the Armand Box? As I understand, the fact that you were in that northerly position meant that Rommel had to send troops up to your position to try and stop you, and then weakened some of his other positions. Did you know anything about Louis at Ridge?
Not really at that early stage, but what often passed through my mind was, if those tanks, instead of turning west, had kept going through to the coast, they would have cut the road off, and whether they would have had infantry to surround us. Because that's what would have been if it had have happened. Because to the best of my knowledge, I didn't know of any forces in this immediate area. I knew that there were forces further towards Alexandria, but if they had surrounded us Well, we wouldn't have been able to get any supplies in or anything. But it always just passed through my mind, what could have happened. But as far as, we got a lot of information. Well, I mean, you knew when there was an action underway around in the eastly part, or towards the coastal area, and because that was all access controlled lands towards Derna and Tobruk and things of that nature. So
you went back to the infantry position. How long were you then in that general area for? Up until that?
Well, we did do a few moves, like relieving or relieving somebody that was in another position, and then we would come back to ours afterwards. They'd come into ours, but we, to the best of my memory, we were pretty stationary in that one area. Though, as I said, we did go and relieve in other positions, but we never. There wasn't any actual involvement. So, even in the 23rd of October operation, it wasn't then until we were pulled out from around about our area to go and take over from someone who they had to relieve them because the hill had belted out of them. But we went to take the positions, the guns were all blown out there. And so we just had to come back to our original position because the people that we were to relieve were unable to, well, there weren't that many that came out of it.
Did you know later on of the situation at Ruin Ridge? When did you hear about that?
We knew, I would say, a matter of a day or two after the whole thing had sort of settled down and everybody knew the powers that be knew what had happened. But some of the regiment guns were some of the battery guns were in there, not our battery, but others.
What did you hear of what had gone on there?
Well, basically, they'd been annihilated. And that's when the powers to be had to reform the battalion, and they were calling from all and sundries to rebuild the battalion. Of course, the LOBs would be dragged up straight away, but I mean they'd only be a bit of a handful sort of business. But quite a number of the fellows from the 24th anti-tank that were now a part of the 3rd anti-tank regiment, they transferred across to the 28th. And I'm not too sure that some actually transferred before Ruin Ridge to, and whether the battalion had lost or had casualties that required immediate reinforcements, but I've got an idea that some of the West Australians in the 3rd anti-tank are transferred to the 28th because some of those fellows ended up prisoners of war and killed in Ruin Ridge. So.
What was the feeling then amongst the troops hearing that the battalion was gone?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a disaster, but what could you do? It just have to be remedied some way. They were fortunate enough to draw on other Australian troops, leftovers that hadn't gone back to Australia. Well, they were press ganged just about, I suppose, into the battalion. But whereas if there wasn't anybody, they'd have just had to draw and bring up New Zealanders or Indians or British troops.
What then did you feel at the time, around about 27th, 28th, yeah, and beyond July, about the situation in regard to the Allied position at Alamein, in the Alamein box at that point?
I think, in hindsight, that we were basically nearly in a siege situation because there were stationary periods. Rommel's had his problems with supply lines and fuel and and the likes and parts and things like that. At that time, that's the early part of, the August, August, September. We were still trying to build up, because most of the supplies were coming in from around South Africa, from America, trucks and guns and things of that nature, and it was just being built up.
I understand that after, from this point on, from Ruin Ridge on, there was a bit of a lull. You had the two sides building up their forces, but there was this change in command. Churchill had wanted, as I understand, to keep the push going, and Auchinleck was replaced by Alexander. How was that change seen? And at this point, obviously, Montgomery comes on the scene.
Well, before Montgomery came on, I mean, there were quite a number of changes that occurred within the divisions or within the corps. There were people being removed for one reason or another, good or bad, you can never find out at any rate. But as far as the changeover of the commanders in chief, you didn't know the real story, and you knew that Churchill, if things went his way, he'd get the short shift. And if you fell foul of him for some reason or other, you'd get booed. So that's for the lower deck troops and things like that. Well, they wouldn't really know what it was. They'd know that they'd had a fair idea that Churchill wasn't happy, and what can you do about that? And and to the best of my knowledge, I don't think anybody was sort of disrespectful to one or the other of them, or generally to any of them at the top echelon that. Got the short shift sort of business. I mean, Wavell and a few of those. I mean, they were reasonably well respected by the troops in general. So, from there, well, I think the next move was Montgomery.
Well, how was he seen then?
Well, I suppose you could say a bit of a firebrand. I mean, reputation-wise, but we didn't know anything about his capabilities or things of that nature. But when he did come into the place, and he probably did a appreciation of the situation, and one of the things that we all sought to appreciate was that he got down into Cairo and shifted all that mob out of the 712, quick smart. And
sorry, what mob was this?
Well, the shiny bums that were down there, people, I don't know how they got these sort of jobs, but they held high-ranking positions, and they'd all meet at the, say the stories go, they'd all meet at the Shepherd's Hotel, for sippers or what you like, or they may have been in on the support facilities and things of that nature, but they you know, nothing upset them, and they didn't want anything to upset them, so that's the way they lived, and they lived like swells down there. So he fixed that situation up, and then the supplies start to come through, transport, and as I said before, tanks, and American tanks were coming through with the bigger guns and more or bigger armaments, and though the design part was nothing compared to the German tanks, which were squat, and whereas these the Grants and all the Shermans and all those were quite sizable outfits. They had gunpowder and that, but they were quite easy. You didn't have any trouble seeing them, sort of business. But
how did the arrival of these you know, better tanks and that sort of thing lift the morale of the troops?
Even some of the British tanks, the Crusaders and a few more, the better or the bigger ones than that, they were still carrying 2-pounders as their weaponry. I mean, what chance would you have with those? And of course, the things that also had been, they'd been out in the desert for a good while, so they were maintained to the best of their ability, so they would depreciate all the time, and there was always breakdowns, and they either bogged or some damn thing or other. And so you had those, whereas with all these new ones, they had greater power and things of that nature. And
did you understand Montgomery's ideas for how the army would tackle the opposing force from this point on?
I mean, his planning took some time. I mean, and of course, he had to straighten out his planning teams and all make the assessments of who he wanted and all those sort of things. But it was like a new broom sweeping things clean. And once he'd set up his controls and things of that nature, you could see the planning that was going ahead. It was quite obvious there were vehicles, camouflaged all over the place and set up for falsifying possible troop movements and things of that nature. Ammunition and water and food and stuff was planned for the big attack, and then there were diversionary probes into the German areas, like a jock column, which I think that was called the Bulimba Show or something. That wasn't very successful, but it just stirred things up a bit. But when it came to the lead up to the 23rd of October, the planning and the information that was passed down through the lines was absolutely something unusual from what had happened in the past. I mean, troops they weren't given, you know, final details, but they knew what the program was going to be and how everything was hopefully worked out. So that was the and there was special training. Gun troops were taken out down south and put through certain actions and things of that nature.